Evidence and Answers begins right now. This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Is archaeology a friend or foe of the Bible? Joining us today is Dr. Scott Stripling, a biblical archaeologist, who explains how archaeology enriches our understanding of biblical history, strengthens Christian apologetics, and equips believers to discern truth from sensational claims. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this interview entitled Digging for Truth. And you'll also find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into the conclusion of this fabulous interview.
I took over for Bryant and served as director of excavations there for the last four seasons, and then was responsible for the publication of volume 2 there. It's a small site, which is what I should be in the Bible. It has a gate on the north, which the Bible says that the gate of Ai was on the north. It's occupied at the right time. And it has an ambush site on the west, a shallow valley to the north, a hill to the north where the Bible says Joshua would have been. So kind of topographically and geographically, and then we, as we found, archaeologically as well, we could verify from the pottery and from the destruction layer and so forth, we were able to date it to that time period. It seemed to us that I had moved, the name had moved to a nearby location. And this happens a lot in the biblical world. Look at Jericho. It moved. Old Testament Jericho is not the same as New Testament Jericho. It's 2 miles away. So that this happens. And if Et-Tel was occupied in some way at the time, then there was a relationship between the two. Maybe the residential part of Ai was in Et-Tel, but the fort was at Kerbet el-Makkadr. So our years of excavation there, that of course Bryant gets the lion's share of the credit, having founded the project and so forth, demonstrated that it was occupied at the time. There were women living there, as the Bible indicated, met the topographical, geographical, and archaeological requirements of it. And I, as I like to say, we solved the problem of Ai. I think we did.
Yes. How has the other side, their response to your discoveries there at Kerbet el-Makkadr?
Well, skeptical from the start, of course. Anytime you're dealing with something that seems to be apologetic, or these people are Bible believers, and all of a sudden that means we're not qualified archaeologists, or they're going to argue with Bryant about the pottery. I mean, if you want to argue about the pottery, don't try to say Bryant wasn't qualified. I mean, he earned a PhD from University of Toronto in late Bronze Age pottery. How much more of a nerd could you be, as far as if the issue is pottery? It has nothing to do with whether he's a Bible believer or not. Is someone right or someone wrong? So many times when they're losing the argument, they'll bring this in. We can't be intellectually honest because we're just trying to prove our paradigm, as if I would falsify the facts or something like that to make it say something that it didn't say. If we were going to do that, Patrick, we would have done it at Kerbet Nisya. We excavated at Kerbet Nisya for many years and walked away from it and said, the evidence is not here. So Kerbet el-Makkadr turned out to be a great case study. It was unencumbered by modern ruins. And so to bring my students to a place like that, it was like our own laboratory. We had this Second Temple period village, which was incredible, probably the village of Ephraim from John 11:54. And then underneath that is likely the village of Ai, talked about so prominently in the conquest account.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the discoveries there at Ai.
Okay, well, we had things like infant jar burials, which were important to us because they helped date. Also, some had made the argument that there would not have been women living at a military fortress. And of course, there were. We had neonates buried in jars. So clearly there were women who were living there. The pottery was very important. And I've not seen this at other sites. It's what we called refired pottery. It was like concrete. It was so hard. So we thought it had been fired in a kiln, and then it was in a conflagration, a site-wide fire, and fired to a very high heat a second time. And, you know, normally we scrape pottery to try to understand the hardness. This is the hardest stuff that any of us had ever seen. And so the pottery was interesting. The fortification system, although a bit chewed up, we did recover from the gate complex and hundreds of sling stones and militaria, a decapitated idol, an icon, the Egyptian god Khnum, the creates man on his potter's wheel and has the goat's head. We found the decapitated figurine. Of course, Moses had told the Israelites, when you come into the land, decapitate the idols of the Canaanites. And I believe that's what was an example of. So when we began to improve our technology, we began to metal detect. And it's shocking how many digs were and still are not even metal detecting. We began to metal detect. We began to sift everything. And of course, now we're wet sifting everything. Our finds became exponential. And it's sad how many things we archaeologists may have missed in the past because our methodology needed a little strengthening.
Tell us about a little bit. How high do you think the walls of the city were? And what was the size of the city? You know, Joshua said, hey, we don't need our whole army on this one. So how big was this city? And what do you think the population was?
2.5 acres or so inside the walled settlement. The wall was about 3.5 meters wide, the fortification wall. 3.5 to 4, it varied a little bit. So there was an outer 1 meter and an inner 1 meter that were very solid, and then it was fill in between there. It was scavenged at some points by later builders, but some parts of it were still intact as well. It would have probably had a mud brick superstructure on top of it that had collapsed in antiquity. Most archaeological sites that we're walking on, that decomposed earth is mud brick, you know, that has fallen many, many years ago. The population you wouldn't have had in a small site like that, you know, inside the fortification, no more than a couple hundred people. Mm-hmm. Now, you could squeeze in, of course, double or triple that in a time of conflict. But normally on a day-to-day basis, it's a small place. And so you can see why Joshua said, we're just going to send a little bit of the army over there. We don't need to send
it. Yeah. So it seems to match up well with the biblical text here.
Yeah. And that's a problem, by the way, with Et Tel, which is much larger, 36 acres, much larger than Gibeon. And the Bible says that it's smaller than Gibeon. And certainly much larger than Jericho, 4 times the size of Jericho. Whereas the implication is that Ai is much smaller.
Yeah. Well, the site that you are directing now is Shiloh there in the Old Testament. Tell us about the importance of this particular city.
Shiloh, that's my dream job. If Jericho was the first site of the conquest, Shiloh's the last site. And so when the Israelites come to Shiloh, they have now finished the initial conquest. And Joshua gives out the tribal allotments there from the tent of meeting, and it becomes the center then of Israelite life and worship for over 3 centuries. We know that there was a sacrificial system that operated there. The Bible talks about a gate complex there at Shiloh. And so, needless to say, we were interested when we had the opportunity by invitation to go to Shiloh to work there. Our work at Kirby El Mikater, by the way, was in the middle of nowhere. I mean, nobody went to visit us. It's off the beaten path and very rugged excavation, no water, no bathrooms, you know, just a tough thing that we did, and we're glad that we did it. But we honed our protocols during that time. We built our team. And then when the invitation from the Antiquities Authority came to go to Shiloh, I was, of course, thrilled to do this. Mm-hmm. And it was another conquest site that we would have a chance to explore. And that we had identified tentatively 8 layers of occupation at Shiloh. Now we know that there were 9 from the Middle Bronze Age II up and through the Islamic period. So as we go down deeper in the archaeological tell, of course, the older the material comes. And to my great surprise, we began to uncover evidence of the sacrificial system. And I say to my great surprise because I published an article back in 2016 of where I thought the tabernacle would have been at Shiloh, and turns out I was wrong. We began to uncover this building that matches the dimensions, has the favisa due east of it, and divided on 2-to-1 ratios. And I think it's a strong candidate for the biblical tabernacle.
Yeah, you know, I've read some of the articles, And the critics, of course, our friend Finkelstein and others were saying, well, there's nothing here at Shiloh that really matches the biblical text here. And so the work that you're doing there is quite significant. What have you found that seems to match the biblical text? You talked about the tabernacle. How do we know we got the tabernacle?
Well, first of all, let me point people to the biblical text. 1 Samuel 3 begins to talk about the temple of the Lord, not the tabernacle, but the temple of the Lord and the house of the Lord. And the language changes from temporary to permanent. You're now talking about the doors of the house of the Lord and so forth. So scholars and commentaries for many years had picked up on that and said, well, maybe a permanent building was built there based upon that shift in the language. Then in the Mishnah, we have two places, what's called the Zebayim and the Seder Olam, that also state that a permanent building was built at Shiloh with a tent over the top as a roof. So sort of a quasi-tabernacle tent structure. So I was aware of that. And when we began to uncover this building, first of all, wall 10, this massive east-west wall, and then perpendicular walls coming off of it, I was just beside myself. And I said, you know, give me some drone shots, give me the dimensions of the tabernacle and superimpose them upon this and show me where the walls that we're excavating right now are in relation to where they should be. And they were spot on. So in the last several years, we've continued to excavate this building and the walls continue to appear where they should be if this matrix is correct. It's perfectly east-west, and that's important. And it's divided on 2-to-1 ratios. We are finding cultic material inside the innermost area, the Holy of Holies, if you will, miniature pomegranates. Now, the pomegranate is, of course, a motif of the tabernacle because these were on the hems of the priest's garments. We don't find them anywhere else at Shiloh. Only within this room in this building is where we're finding them. So a demolished altar there also within this building, murex shell, which is where they get the dye for the priestly garments. And then most importantly is due east of the building is the favisa. And, you know, according to Ross Kletter's favisa criteria, which is what everyone goes by, you can't have a favisa without a temple. So in other words, if there was a sacrificial system going on somewhere, where's the temple that goes with it? And so we have the two linked together. And then also on the northernmost part of the site, we have what is likely the gate of the city that's mentioned in the biblical text.
Yeah, the gate of the city. I've seen it. It's a pretty impressive site there. That's where Eli ruled from. And that's when he got the news that his sons had been killed and the Ark of the Covenant had been taken. He fell over and died. That's the place.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the gate. And we assume that gate dates all the way back into the late Bronze Age, maybe even the middle Bronze Age. But it continues in use on down into the time of Eli, into the Iron One period. And so, yeah, it's very likely that this is where he was, because from that spot, you can see the Patriarch's Highway and he can see the runner, you know, who's coming and brings him this tragic news that the Ark has been captured. We found in the last 2 years our first human bones at Shiloh, and they were there in the gate complex. And we don't normally find human bone inside of a city unless it's trauma, murder of some sort, because people bury normally outside these cities. And so we found this human cranium there in the gate, the proposed gate area. And so, of course, you can't help but think, wow, you know, maybe this is the remains of Eli that are here. And they're just scattered bones. I mean, we've got a rib bone and a finger bone and a cranium. And so whoever it was really chewed up. And I just read last week, I was reading my Bible in 2 Kings. I don't know remember the chapter offhand, but it was Jezebel. It says that the dogs attacked Jezebel when she was pushed out of the window, and they chewed up her skeleton, and that the bones were scattered all over the place when they finished with it. And so made me think of, like, if Shiloh was destroyed and then Eli dies, and if he wasn't buried, you know, possibly the body was scavenged.
Yeah, you know, skeptics argue that perhaps this was just a village, not a significant city in the life of Israel, but the excavations there and have shown it, this was a significant city here.
Yeah, but different from other cities because it's a cultic center, right? So the people living in this city are priests. Incidentally, we don't have any domestic structures at Shiloh until this building is built that I'm talking about. And then they begin to build houses for themselves. And that's very interesting, isn't it? Kind of that idea of how can we build ourselves a house when God is still living in a tent? Once this structure is built at Shiloh, then we begin to find domestic dwellings as well.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned that may enhance the biblical text here, you said that the city may have been attacked. Perhaps, do you think it was after the Philistines defeated the Israelites and took the ark?
It looks like it was because we have a site-wide destruction that we've radiocarbon dated to, and also ceramically, because we have a sealed locus, like a plastered floor. And on top of that, we had Iron Age IIa pottery, the time of David and Solomon, let's say. So underneath that sealed locus, I said, man, this is great. If the pottery underneath here should be Iron Age I, like collard rim jars. And if there's a destruction layer, it should radiocarbon date to about 1070, 1075 BC. And fortunately, there was a destruction layer underneath there. There were collard rim jars from Iron Age I, and they did radiocarbon dates did come in to that horizon of time. So I think it's likely that that's the Philistine destruction of Shiloh that the Bible doesn't explicitly say happened. It implies it. Psalm 78 implies the Philistine destruction of Shiloh, but it doesn't explicitly state it. And this is a great example of what biblical archaeology is. So here's something we didn't know that we thought may have happened. And now because of archaeology, we can say with a high degree of confidence that yes, it was indeed destroyed by the Philistines.
Yeah, so those are two great digs that you led there. Is there any other really significant digs you see going on that we should, keep our antennas up about?
Oh boy, there are a lot of interesting digs. Jerusalem has some fascinating projects going on right now. The Ophel, Hebrew University's excavation at the Ophel between the Temple Mount and the City of David is really interesting because they are excavating the what I believe is the gate of Jerusalem talked about in 1 Kings 9:15. And so I would definitely keep my eye on that Ophel excavation. We just found out last week that in the City of David itself, there was this dam that was built actually toward the Tyropian Valley that sort of changes our understanding of hydrological matters and how they moved water in those early time periods. So lots and lots of interesting things. The pilgrimage road going from the Siloam Pool up to the Temple Mount is about to open, and tourists will soon be able to, trek through that. Lachish is under excavation, and I think Lachish is, outside of Jerusalem, has always been the second most important site in Judah. So I would definitely keep an eye on that. There are a lot of salvage digs that are going on in Judea and Samaria right now. It's smaller sites that I think are going to help us really understand the settlement patterns in the Central Hill Country, which is where Israel settled in the earliest days. Right across the highway from Shiloh, there's a site called Tel Rafid. We sometimes call that Shiloh's older sister because it has an early Bronze Age occupation. So yeah, there's a lot in the typical year, about 100 excavations going on in a site like Israel, but there are 30,000 archaeological sites in the country. And so, disproportionately work is going on in the coastal plain and the Shephelah. But now, for many years, we were the only ones working in the highlands, which Judea, Samaria, maybe because of the tensions, not everybody wanted to deal with West Bank type issues. But I'm pleased to see more work going on there now.
Yeah, I see a consistency. The more and more we are discovering, the pendulum seems to be swinging in favor of the Bible, not against it. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, I do. And that's not to say that we're not going to at some point excavate places and not find what we were expecting to find. because absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. I mean, there are lots of reasons that evidence may not be in an archaeological tale. Jerusalem is the quintessential case, by the way. We all know Jerusalem was occupied in the late Bronze Age, okay? The Amarna letters talk extensively about what's going on. King Abdi-Heba of Jerusalem, and Elat Mazar, by the way, found apparently an archival copy of one of those letters there on the Ophel. But later builders would tear down to bedrock. So they would remove the earlier structures and get all the way down to bedrock. So the pottery's all over the place, the inscriptions and the radiocarbon material, but you're not going to find the structures because each, you know, sort of civilization that comes is going back down to bedrock. So some of the challenges that we deal with, this is why we archaeologists love a good destruction level, okay? Mm-hmm. A good earthquake to wipe things out and just kind of seal it in place so we can come along and excavate it later.
Yes, you've been listening to our interview on biblical archaeology with Dr. Scott Stripling here. Scott, as we close the show, tell us a little bit about the Bible Seminary and the Near East Archaeological Society here and how people can get more information on you and the things you're doing.
Oh, awesome. Well, thanks for asking. The Bible Seminary is an accredited nonprofit organization. We teach biblical archaeology and we have other majors right now, just master's degrees, five master's degrees. We hope to be adding PhD programs in the future, but people can attend from anywhere in the world. We have students all over the world. I'm teaching this semester a biblical archaeology course. If somebody still wants to jump in, they can still jump in late and even get into that course and just audit it if they want, which is a very inexpensive thing to do. The Near East Archaeological Society, of I serve as president currently, is a consortium of scholars from all over, primarily North America, but also from all over the world, who come together once a year, each November. We hold a conference and we have speakers. We present research from our excavations. We learn from each other. We have a peer-reviewed journal, the Near East Archaeological Society Bulletin, which we also publish annually. And we are also this year publishing a festschrift in honor of the great ancient Near Eastern scholar, Edwin Yamauchi, who was our president for many years. And that will be out next year. So we're an academic institution. Folks can go to neasociety.org to learn more. And please join. It's very inexpensive. It helps us. And believe me, it will help you. You'll start getting our journal and Artifacts magazine on top of that, and just a wealth of resources. So thebibleseminary.edu, neasociety.org. My personal website is scottstripling.net. If folks want to go there, they can easily find me.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Near East Archaeological Society, and you mentioned Edwin Yamauchi. You know, I graduated from the same high school as Yamauchi here in Hawaii. So,
oh my goodness, that's incredible.
I'm trying to follow in his footsteps.
Well, those are big footsteps, believe me. You know, he'll turn 90 next year.
Yeah.
We're hoping that the festschrift will come out on his 90th birthday so that we can honor him with that.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great if he could show up there.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he's going to physically make it, but at least he is still writing and researching, but he's not really able, you know, out and about these days. We'd like to be able to honor him while he's still walking among us.
Mm-hmm. A great warrior who fought the good fight there. Yes. When biblical archaeology seemed to be going the other way. He was one of those guys in there taking his stand, which is what you and this new generation is doing now.
Well, thank you, Patrick, and kudos to you. I appreciate your good work, and what you're doing there in Hawaii is a blessing to see, and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Yes, you've been listening to our interview on biblical archaeology with Dr. Scott Stripling, the provost at the Bible Seminary in Houston, Texas, and president of the Near East Archaeological Society there. So, Scott, thanks for being with us here on Evidence and Answers.
My pleasure.
Again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.